WPPB is supported in part by Sotheby's International Realty, with offices in 40 countries globally and offices locally in the Hamptons in Southampton, Bridgehampton, East Hampton, and Sag Harbor. Our agents are local experts worldwide with a clear mission to pair exceptional properties with exceptional clients and offer them superior white glove service. For more information, email Sotheby's associate broker John Christopher at john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Hi, this is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest, Day Dayton, who is the president of the Long Pond Greenbelt. Hi, Day, how are you?
I'm fine. Nice to meet you.
You're mouthing something over
there. Friends of the Long Pond Greenbelt.
Oh, I apologize. No wonder you were mouthing. I thought you just going.
I'm just the president of the whole Greenbelt.
I thought you had a tick over there. Anyway, hi, Day. Okay, so a lot of people aren't aware of the Long Pond Greenbelt, correct?
Yes.
Can you tell us about it? What is the Long Pond Greenbelt?
It's really amazing. It is an amazing nature preserve right smack in the middle of the Hamptons. And the boundary is about 1,100 acres. So it's surprising that people don't know about it.
Yeah.
It also has one of the highest concentrations of rare plants and animals in New York State.
In the state of New York?
Yes. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And animals? What kind of animals would be there as compared to, say, up in Dutchess County?
Well, we have the endangered eastern tiger salamander, which is fascinating. And we have some.
Why is he endangered? The people, animals, people or something?
Well, mostly habitat loss, which is true with everything now.
Nowadays, especially out here in the Hamptons.
Yes, yes.
It's a good thing we have the Peconic Land Trust, otherwise everything would be gone.
And the Community Preservation Fund is saving
helping.
A lot of land.
Exactly. So how long has the Friends of the Long Pond Greenbelt, how long have they been in existence?
Well, we started back in about... Well, it's been 20 years. I can't say about. We're celebrating our 20th year.
No kidding. This year's the 20th?
Yes, yes. We began with another group called Save Vineyard Field and Save Vineyard Woods, which also turned into Save Black Pond. And then once that happened...
I'm not familiar. Where's Black Pond?
Black Pond is part of the Long Pond Greenbelt.
Wow. Yeah. Now, I know there's quite a few ponds. How many ponds are... part of the Long Pond Greenbelt?
There are 13 coastal plain ponds.
Now, when you say coastal, is that in and out, water rising, going
down? Yeah, it's our aquifer, actually. They're fed from our aquifer. Yeah.
See, this
amazing.
I'm getting educated here, you know, and hopefully our listeners are also getting the education. So what prompted you to get involved with the Long Pond Greenbelt?
Well, it started, actually, I grew up in East Hampton, romping around in the woods and riding my horse. And when I moved to Sagaponack, I started riding with a group of riders up in the Sagaponack Hills, which led to the Long Pond Greenbelt. But then one day, those survey flags appeared.
And you couldn't cross that?
We were like, oh, no. But then we started it in 86, the Southampton Trails Preservation Society, and started preserving the trails. And then the Long Pond Greenbelt, we discovered, really hadn't been totally preserved. And we started working
to preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that 20-year period, you've preserved quite a bit of land, would you say?
In Southampton town, we now have 300 miles of trails.
300 miles?
Yeah.
So where does it begin and where does it end?
The Long Pond Greenbelt begins, actually, in Sag Harbor, the Sag Harbor Cove and Ligony Creek, Otter Pond. And then it continues south all the way to Sag Pond in the ocean. It's a chain, a beautiful chain of ponds.
So you can take go into Sag Harbor, begin the trail there, and end up...
You'll end up actually at Peters Pond Beach.
Wow.
On the Beta Ocean Trail, yes.
Now how long is that? I mean, miles, would you say?
That trail, we have 9 miles of trails actually in the Greenbelt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so. Wow, that's fascinating. So... when you're walking on this trail, can you take horses? By the way, you said you you can take horses. I wasn't aware of that. So that must
There's just no motorized vehicles.
Right, right, right. Now, that must be something also you're involved in, because with the ATVs, what are you doing about that? Is there anything taking place or a stir?
Well, that's how our membership helps a lot. We report when they come in, and they're doing a lot of destruction, actually.
Oh, are they really?
Yeah,
no, because I've seen them, you see them with the high-tension wires.
Yeah.
And they use those.
They're not legally allowed on any public land on Long Island.
I didn't know that.
No, they don't seem to know it either. Well, actually, I do think they know it, but unfortunately, there isn't an area designated for them to ride.
That is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Now, you also have ongoing nature studies. How can, and it says that people can contribute to that. How do you do that? How
well,
do people
we mostly ask for volunteers. We test the ponds and we do maintenance on the trails. And we have a Sundays at 2 program that we try to bring in speakers. So anyone who has an interesting topic, we would love to have them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they now, where do they meet? Where does this take place when you say we have speakers?
Is the Long Pond Greenbelt Nature Center, which, again, many people don't know
about. I didn't even know. Well, here, pray tell.
Yeah. The Community Preservation Fund purchased 9 acres on the Bridgehampton Turnpike, which actually used to be Val Schaffner's home. So the house itself has become a nature center. And our volunteers keep it open on Saturday and Sunday, and we do the Sundays at 2 once a month, and we try to get as many volunteers as we can to come. And
Where is it? How do you get to it?
Well, just head up the turnpike towards Sag Harbor.
Sag Turnpike,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, from Bridgehampton to Sag Harbor, just as you pass Scuttle Hole, it's on your right.
And
you'll suddenly notice a wooden sign with a map on it.
Right. But it doesn't say anything about a house or anything like that.
No, but it is the nature center.
That's the nature center. Mm-hmm. So that's how you get to the nature center.
Yeah, it's a very long driveway.
So can you drive that?
You can drive down to the nature center.
So you don't need a SUV or anything like
that? No, it's a driveway.
Oh, okay.
And then that's also the start of our tree identification trail.
Wow.
Walk, yeah, that's which is very nice. The kiosk is there, and you can pick up a brochure.
And this happens every Sunday at 2 o'clock?
Once a month.
Oh, once a month.
During the summer, yeah.
Okay. Oh, only during the summer.
Unless we get more volunteers and they would like to start more programs, the more the better.
Right, exactly. There it goes.
Yeah.
So now you also do, when you say once a month, is also the full moon.
Yes, we have a full moon hike in the beautiful Vineyard Field. Every full moon, rain, shine, snow.
Snow?
Yeah, we're lunatics.
Now, I assume you're out there with snowshoes, right?
Well, yeah.
Or
any way we can go. It's fun. It's very beautiful. We co-sponsor with the South Fork Natural History Museum, and they open the museum for us so we can warm up. And we can look at the displays. And it's not a long hike, so it's easy for everyone. We keep the trail mowed wide. I know people are concerned about ticks.
Right.
But, it's about 45 minutes. Can be shorter if you'd just like to go in and sit down and have the refreshments.
The question is, what kind of refreshments?
Oh, they're great.
I'm sure they are.
Hot cider.
That's my favorite. So that's every month. Now, what time does that start? So that
well,
people
it
are
depends
interested.
When the moon rises and
so
the sunset.
Okay.
You'd have to come onto our site and see what time.
I got you.
So always at the same place. So.
Okay, so what is your site?
Oh, I wrote it down because I forget. It's longpondgreenbelt.org.
Longpondgreenbelt.org.
And then you can contact us at greenbeltnews@aol.com.
Okay, what's that called?
If you have any questions.
Greenbeltnews.com. At AOL. That's the email. Okay.
Yes, that's the email.
That's fantastic. Well, you know what? We've wrapped this up. I'm looking forward to the next full moon, and you'll see me there.
Great.
You know, and that's like right after sunset, right? And you meet at the house there that's...
Well, we meet behind the museum.
Behind the South
Fork Natural History Museum, which is 377 Bridgehampton Turnpike.
Oh, wonderful.
And that field behind the museum is owned by Southampton Town, is a public trail system. open at all times.
That is wonderful.
It's beautiful.
That is fantastic. I'm so happy you came on the program today. It's been a delight having you on here. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back after the short break with Laura Fabricio of the Merchants Bay Project. Hi, this is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest Laura Fabricio of the Merchants Bay Project. Hi, Laura. How are you?
Hi there. How are you?
I'm doing great, Laura. Now, you've been involved with the Merchants Bay Project. How did you become involved?
Well, it actually started over a slice of pizza.
Pizza.
My friend and co-founder of the Merchants Bay Project, Aram Tertunian, invited myself and Dwight Surrigan over for pizza and lunch. And he had the idea, because we had been talking often about the issues in the Bay and how it's not getting any better. And specifically, Mauritius Bay seemed to have been the forgotten bay because it falls between two towns, Mauritius, Southampton Town and Brookhaven Town. So that afternoon, we just formulated the Mauritius Bay Project and have been going strong ever since.
Now, when did this take place?
We just finished our fourth summer.
Wow. So, okay. So since when? We're now, I guess, what, 2013 would it be?
Somewhere around, 2013. Somewhere in March we started, yes.
Okay, got it. So one of the things is that you're cleaning the bay and you're doing this via oysters. Why are they so important?
Well, I don't know if you know this, but one adult oyster filters 50 gallons of water every single day. Mm. So this summer alone, we put in 400,000 oysters.
Now, how do you do that?
There's a couple of different methods. First of all, we use the community as our volunteer base. We're very fortunate that people in the local area, we from Quag to Mauritius, really care about the community that they live in and really want to get involved. We like to target young kids because we feel like they're our future and they can actually get involved from a young age and continue throughout high school. So there's three different methods that we use to putting oysters in the bay. The first is what we call oyster farming, and that is where we take cages, small cages, and we have we put roughly around 500 oysters in each cage, and we have the kids come out and the community come out and set up a farm. We work very, very closely with Cornell Cooperative, and we do what we call like little hands-on lectures and demonstrations, and we build these farms. Each farm roughly to date holds about 10,000 oysters, and we build the farms, we put the oysters in, and then we get a group of kids or some people from the community together, and they actually maintain and manage those farms. So, for example, one of our farms are managed by the Boy Scouts. Another one is managed by...
Can they get badges, by the way? Do the Boy Scouts get a badge for this?
I don't know if they can get a badge, but they get, you know, they it goes towards their badges that they're trying to...
Understood.
...to get.
Right.
So we have another group that's managed by... the Mauritius Yacht Club, the West Hampton Beach Yacht Club, is involved. They manage one of our sites. So then the next step is we'd have farms, and then what we just started doing recently is putting flupsies in the water.
Flupsies. What are flupsies?
I was waiting for you to ask that question.
A little different than flip-flops, right?
A little, yes. Flupsies are floating upwellers. And basically, a floating upweller can hold up to 100,000 oysters. And the beauty of a flupsy, besides the fact that it can hold five times the amount of oysters that a farm can hold, is that it has a small engine on the bottom of it, a small motor, and it turns the nutrients from the bottom of the bay and it brings it up into these plastic canisters that hold the oysters, and it gives them more nutrients faster, so they grow bigger, stronger, and in a faster rate. So in a farm, an oyster grows from the size of a dime to let's say 1.5 inches, which is the size you want to get to put them into the water, in roughly 9 to 10 months. In a flupsy, that can be done in roughly 6 months.
Wow.
So it speeds up the process, and not only that, but you're putting five times the amount in.
Right.
And then lastly, we work with Cornell and we do spat on shells, which is baby oysters that are actually set on bigger shells. And those go directly into the bay. And currently right now we have three oyster beds where we are trying to put these, we put these oysters into the beds and these baby oysters, and we go back and we monitor them to see if they're growing. And we've had some really, really great success in all three of our, in three of the beds that we are using. These oysters have really grown to be a nice full size. So those are the three methods that we're currently using.
So what do you think are some of the challenges of the Mauritius Bay? What are they facing? What
kind of challenges? One of the challenges is that it's kind of been the unspoken bay. And one of the things that I'm really most proud of is the Mauritius Bay Project has given Mauritius Bay a voice. We've brought it to light. People now recognize that Mauritius Bay does need help, and it's not just the bay's east or the bay's west. So we're really proud of the recognition that we brought to it and the awareness that we brought to it. I mean, the bay needs help there. It's, you know, the nitrates and the brown tides and the dirt. I mean, it's just, it needs to be cleaned. And you know, this is just one way that we're doing it through oyster farming.
Right. Well, the project has this unique strategy, which involves action, education, and community. Can you elaborate on that?
One of the things that we feel that we can really do is bring awareness to the issues in the bay. By bringing awareness, we're hoping to achieve action. If somebody knows about something, then they have the ability to act on it. If you don't know the issues and you don't know the concerns, then you don't know to do anything. And as I said earlier, we use the community as our volunteers. We call them kind of our workforce. So that's a great source of people to get involved. One of the things that we do that we feel is different from other organizations that do what we do is we go to schools. We talk to the kids. We do hands-on demonstrations. And we bring awareness to all the kids. The kids go home at night. They talk about it at dinner. And we feel like that's been a great source of an area for us to kind of bring attention to what's
right.
going on.
Exactly. Now, one of the things I know in 2013, you eliminated 3 pounds of nitrogen from the Mauritius Bay.
Yes.
How many pounds are you planning for this year?
Well, in 2013, we only put in about 50,000 oysters.
And you can only get 3 pounds of nitrogen removed.
Right.
Wow, that's...
But what
have you done? I know it doesn't seem like a lot.
I haven't calculated out the exact amount of nitrogens that we've taken out of the water yet. We're still in the process.
Would you project like 400 or so pounds? I mean, it's considerable. You've done.
It is, yes, and we're really proud of what we did. And we actually, this year, for the first time, we've been doing water monitoring. And if you go to our website, you can see that there's a link to, and you can actually see real live on-time data as to these water monitoring systems. And this year, we added nitrates. So we're hoping to be able to calculate the nitrates and to be able to formulate a better calculation on what we're actually doing. We put each one of these water monitoring stations right by one of our flupsies. And just to get back to the flupsies, this year we put in 4 flupsies. We have a total of 4 flupsies in there.
That's great. So you have like over 4,000 volunteers. So how does someone become a volunteer? What do they need to do?
Well, you need to email us and say you want to get involved.
And what's your email and what's your website?
Our email address is mauritiusbayproject@gmail.com, and our website is mauritiusbayproject.org.
Now, suppose somebody wants to donate. How can they do that?
You can just email me at mauritiusbayproject@gmail.com, and we will be very happy to take your donations.
And what is that email again?
mauritiusbayproject@gmail.com.
That's fantastic. Laura Fabricio, it's been a delight having you on the program. And this is John Christopher for Real Life, the people, places, and things that are the heartbeat and pulse of the East End. And we'll be right back after this short break with our next guest, Allegra DiAguardi of Styled and Sold. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and today I have as my guest Allegra DiAguardi, who is with Styled and Sold. Hi, Allegra. How are you today?
Hi, John. I'm great.
Good. You look wonderful. And before we get started, I just want to know, Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the village of Stony Brook.
Stony Brook. Mm-hmm. So it's not that far away from this area. Now, are you still located in Stony Brook or are you out here in the Hamptons?
I'm in West Hampton Beach.
Wonderful. So how did you get to West Hampton Beach from Stony Brook?
Well, I always came out here when I was younger. I hung out with surfers.
Oh, and, you were a surfer girl?
Well, I was a surfer girlfriend. And then my mother, who was a real estate broker, moved out here when I was in my 20s. And my sister quickly followed her and moved out to Sag Harbor, and she's been here forever.
So your sister's in real estate also?
No, she is at Sag Harbor Express.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. What's her name? By
Ellen Diogardi.
Oh, okay. I think I know her. Right. Yeah. That's interesting. So when did you first have the stirrings of wanting to be an interior designer?
Well, I started out as a biology major, believe it or not.
Wow.
And after one semester, I realized that wasn't for me. And I was kind of jumping from major to major. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wanted to do something important that would help people. And I saw an ad in the New York Times for Parsons School of Design, evening program, and I thought, oh, I can't do that. And my girlfriend, who was a designer, said, hey, wait a minute. I create beautiful environments for people where they're more productive and they live better lives. And I went, And I decided to go ahead and take that one class, and I was hooked.
And then what did you continue from that point?
I did. I got my degree from Parsons.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. Now, coming out of Parsons, what happened then?
My very first job was model home interiors. I worked for a large firm, and I traveled all over the country working for national builders.
So you would set up their...
Their model homes, which Long Island, we don't see as many as the rest of the country.
Right.
But I'd fly, you know, to South Carolina, Florida, Texas, working on model homes.
So was that like in the early stages of staging?
That was before the term staging was ever heard. I was called an interior merchandiser.
So you'd go in and have furniture in mind and say, okay.
I'd actually start with the blueprints and work with the builders, sometimes critiquing the floor plans, doing electrical plans, making all the selections. Then I would design built-ins, select all the paint colors, bring in furniture, accessories, window treatments, artwork, the whole, whole bit.
You know, I'm thinking it's interesting that you bring in the female element, because I think it's so important with builders. A lot of times, you know, them being, you know, we don't see many women builders as we do, but there are some, especially out here in the Hamptons. But in any event, I've always said, because I've worked with builders, that you need to have, you know, the a woman really come in and help. And so that's what you were doing.
The design element is important. How are you going to live in this space?
Right. And especially out here in the Hamptons, people, you know, have a certain thinking, you know, they want beachy.
Lifestyle.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. It's about creating a lifestyle.
Correct.
So that is very interesting. Now, speaking of women and men, how do you read your clients? How do you get a click on them?
Well, I can remember in the past, I would have my clients look through design magazines and rip out pictures that they liked just so I could get a feel for what their taste was. But now we have wonderful sites online like House.com and Pinterest. And I direct them to those sites. I really love House because they can create a folder and share it with me. And I can look at it and glean, oh, they like this type of kitchen. They like this type of backsplash. This is the style furniture they like, and so forth.
Wow. That is interesting. So technology has actually made your job a little bit easier.
It's changed it, yeah.
Wow. That is great. Now, my question is, do husbands ever get involved as much so as the woman when it comes to the designing aspect?
I would say not as much, but once the husbands find out that it's not just all about picking pretty colors and that there really is some science behind it, I think a lot of them get more interested.
Hmm. Now, when you say science, what aspect of science?
Well, for instance, I might explain that I'm going to create a focal point to draw you into the room, or that this particular paint color will visually expand the space, or when I get down to the nitty-gritty and I'm space planning and I pull out my architect scale and I'm saying, well, we need 3.5 feet clearance here,
right,
and so forth, you know, then they start to, oh, there's more to this than just picking pretty things.
Wow.
And picking pretty things is part of it, though.
Right. I can imagine. It's interesting that you say pink. Do you use pink?
Because I'm picking pretty things.
Oh, I thought you said pink.
No.
I'm sorry. I was just thinking, you know, from a man's standpoint, I think of pink, okay, maybe as the daughter's bedroom.
Yeah. No, I don't use a lot of pink.
Oh, okay. Good. So I misheard you. Okay. So now, with new construction, we're talking about builders. Do you think it's important to stage a vacant home?
It's important to stage any kind of home, but particularly vacant homes, because unless the house has a lot of really interesting architectural details, there's not a lot to get people to stop and pause in the space. And I think staging is about visual clues, creating visual clues how you would live in the space so that you can form an emotional connection to the space.
Right, right, right. So it's almost like it's easier to... Because from the standpoint of having a vacant room, and then when you see a room that's been staged, you can really put yourself into that environment.
Yeah. And you know how important the online photos are these days. And if you're just looking at a vanilla box and you don't even know what room you're in, and you see a lot of them and they're all white and the kitchens are white with the same kind of marble countertops, at the end of the day, if you've looked at 10 houses, what's going to have created memory? What's going to stand out?
That's a very good point, right. Mm-hmm. So have you had a client tell you that your staging has helped them sell the house?
All the time.
All the time?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you must be doing something right.
Well, I mean, there is kind of science behind it, as I said. And I've had clients whose houses were on the market for an extended period, and we staged the house, reintroduced it to the market, and the first weekend they've had multiple full price offers.
Wow, that is amazing. Now, one of the other aspects of your of styled and sold is that you do estate sales.
Yes.
So what's involved in doing them?
when I do an estate sale, I come into a house, and it's as if this is my store for the week. I bring in my crew. We set it up. We visually merchandise the space because as a designer and stager, I know that things that are beautifully presented sell for more. So we do that. We take care of the advertising in local papers. We send out, I have a mailing list of about 1,500 people. I send out an email blast. I have a Facebook page with about 2,000 followers.
Wow.
And we put a price tag. We research and put a price tag on every item in the house from a teaspoon to we sell cars and boats.
No kidding. Now, like antiques, suppose a home has an antique furniture, like, say, from the 1700s. Mm-hmm. Do you go and research that?
If I need to call in an expert, I do. I have expert people. But unfortunately, the truth about antiques right now is they are not as sellable as modern furniture.
Right, right.
That's the sad thing.
Well, especially
thing,
out here in the Hamptons.
Yep, everywhere.
Oh, everywhere.
Yeah. There's a saying in the industry that brown furniture is dead.
Wow.
I'm sure it'll come back, but right now I do sell it. I do have people who still buy it, but
it's just not happening.
Not as
much. Interesting because I had spoken a while back to an antique dealer, and he had said to me that maybe 5-10 years ago, the prices were much higher, but now they're at least half of that. Is that, you think that's true?
It's true. It's all of the baby boomers who are downsizing.
And they don't want any of the antiques.
Their kids don't want it.
Oh, the kids, right.
The kids don't want it. And, you know, they want something from Restoration Hardware. Right.
Let me ask you something. How can someone get in touch with you, Allegra?
Well, they can check out my website, which is styledandsold.com, or they can call me at 631-599-1297.
Fantastic. It's been a delight having you on the program, Allegra.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life with John Christopher is also brought to you in part by Quantic Bank's lending division that services all of Long Island, Connecticut, and New Jersey. The bank's loan program and services are customized to the individual borrower, including residential, commercial, reverse mortgages, and their community development light doc loan program. More information at Quantic Bank's lending division. Toll free, 888-954-7463. NMLS 403503, Equal Housing Lender.